I feel like we're at the like in some sort of 1950s dance competition, and they're like hour 109, and we're like, yeah, we're yeah, still yeah, yeah. dancing,
like that episode of Happy Days or something, yeah. where they just kept going and going and going.
That's us.
I want to be Ralph Mouth. You can be Potsy.
Okay.
On Taking Pictures, episode 109, take one.
How'd you do the little clap right there?
Just on the back of my hand.
Ah, it was good. I like that.
Wasn't bad?
No, not bad at all.
See, now you've stopped the flow. Now we got to do take two.
All right. Fine.
All right. So we're here every week doing our thing, talking about photography, talking about art and craft, and not arts and crafts. Although we could talk about arts and crafts.
We could. Felting.
But yes, like felt pillows and things mm-hmm. like that. Sure. But not today. How you doing? My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadeandblurred.com. And with me, the felt pillow making fancy photographer, Bill Wadman.
I'm good at that, actually. Felting.
Are you? Needle felt?
Yeah, needle felting.
Yeah.
I've done it once, and I took to it like, you know, a bee to the air or whatever. Yes, I did it well.
Is that the analogy?
Well, the reason I bring up bees is that I actually made a little bumblebee.
It's the new saying sweeping the nation, like a bee to air.
It was very satisfying, actually, poking that thing in there.
Yeah? All
right. Yeah, like really satisfying. It's like, until you, of course, you hit your finger by accident.
That's not good.
Yeah. And then you scream and it just makes you needle harder. Nope. Anyway, go ahead.
Not into that. I don't want to bleed. Bleeding is no bueno.
The blood in the felt makes it more real.
Yeah, yeah. I've bled for you, man. This pillow's got me in it. Yeah. Hey, it's heating up. What's the weather like there? Did you have a nice weekend? Was it hot?
It was all right for the first 2 days, and then yesterday it was warm enough that by the evening, it was hot in our apartment. Like, we were lying in bed and it was hot.
Right.
And we haven't put the air conditioner in yet. We're trying to like hold off for another few weeks so we don't just use it all the time.
What do you have, one of those window ones?
Yeah. Our building was built in 1898, so I think before people discovered where you live.
Yeah. Before people realized, like, it's hot as hell here in the summertime.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a window air conditioner, but I take it out in the wintertime, you know.
Where do you put it?
In the closet.
Right.
It was a little warm, but it's definitely summertime now. It got all of a sudden, boom, yesterday was summer, which is good because
we don't get that here.
Yeah, I know. It's just like that all the time.
That's right.
I'll tell you though, I get a certain level of creative juice when it gets to be this time of year.
Hmm.
Like I'm working on like six things at once right now and they're all good and I'm kind of excited about them. So it's kind of fun, you know?
All right.
I'm a little juiced.
Are you shooting outdoors?
I did yesterday to get a background for a plate for a composite I'm doing, but I'll talk about that a little more later in the show. But yeah, I mean, a little bit outdoors. Yeah. I just shot in the studio on last Friday, and yeah, it was fun. But a lot of stuff going on. So what do we got today? We got lots of stuff.
We got lots of stuff.
You finally made a t-shirt.
I know. They said it wouldn't happen.
Four episodes ago, we're never making a t-shirt.
Yeah, we're never making it. You know, it's and people really like them. They seem to, anyway.
I know. I gotta get myself one.
So yeah, you can get yourself an On Taking Pictures t-shirt, black or white design, and then you can choose the color of the shirt.
Yeah.
I think there are 14 colors or something like that.
Now, who's actually doing the printing for?
Spreadshirt is doing the printing.
Okay.
And went with them for a couple reasons. Number one, so I don't have to have, you know, 1,000 t-shirts in my garage.
Sure.
But two, I like that you can trace their supply chain of the particular shirt that we're using for these. You can, they're you know, fair trade, and they're sort of ethically constructed, and they have this you know, you can trace the DNA of the shirt, if you will. You can go to a site and enter in, you know, a particular code, and it'll trace the supply chain back up the line. So apparently I haven't, you know, looked into it all that deeply, but apparently they're sort of ethically produced, and I kind of like that. So,
you know, what's a nice combination is the yellow t-shirt with the black.
Yeah, somebody ordered one of those, like a big Nikon color thing.
Yeah, that's kind of neat.
I actually made myself a little different one. I did blue on blue.
Okay.
A little special edition.
Oh, just for you, huh?
Just for me.
Must be nice.
Yeah, well.
All right. Well, I'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah. And, yeah. You can find them fadedandblurred.com/merch.
All right. There you go.
But they will be in the show notes.
Okay. Excellent. Looking forward to grabbing
them. Yeah. Been fun.
So I was watching House the other day.
Right.
As I've been wont to do lately. That's one of those shows you just can't stop.
Yeah, but you kind of binge watch shows. You kind of like focus in on one show.
I'll watch that show for 7 seasons over the course of a month or two and then just be done with it. Yeah.
Right.
And I've watched all of House before. And then a few weeks ago, for some strange reason, I was like, I could totally go for like a episode of House right now just to wind down. And so we watched the pilot and then we haven't been able to stop. And now we just finished season 4.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an episode a few days ago where he's talking to a young Jeremy Renner. You know, it just goes
seems like just yesterday.
It goes to prove, though, how much sort of the Hollywood grooming and makeup and all the rest of that has to do with why somebody is famous or not. You know, whenever you see famous people, like before they were famous on some TV show, and you look at them and you go, he's not all that fancy looking. And then you look at him now and you go, wow, he's really good looking. It's all because of like the haircuts and makeup and, you know,
like George Clooney on Facts of Life.
Yeah, exactly. George Clooney, good looking man. Okay. Anyway, Jeremy Renner's on there as some punk rocker or whatever it is. And he was talking about how, oh, I do the music for me and blah, 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 you know, all this kind of stuff. And House says there are 3 options in life: be good, get good, or give up.
Okay.
And I just thought that it was a really good way of saying it. So I tweeted it out, and then I find it in the show notes for today's show. So you must have read it and thought something of it.
I didn't put this in here. You did.
You sure you didn't?
I'm positive.
Okay, well, then I put it in here. Damn it.
Like, how did you find it in the show notes?
But I just know there's something about that where it's like, okay, you know, do it well. And if you're not doing it well, practice until you do it well. But if you're sitting there and you're not practicing and you're not doing it well and you're upset that you're not doing it well, then just give up. Because, like, if you're not going to do it, then why are you talking about it? You know what I mean?
Well, I actually take a little bit of umbrage with this.
Well, then give me what you got.
It assumes that the end result or the end game is to achieve some sort of qualitative standard, not just doing it for the love of it, whatever it is.
Okay.
I know a lot of people who do a lot of different things that they're not particularly good at, but they get a great deal of enjoyment from it.
Right.
And shouldn't that be a marker? Maybe not the marker, but shouldn't it be a marker?
Well, there's nothing to say that you have to end up being good in the end, as long as you keep trying to get good at it. I don't think anybody does something a whole bunch of times expecting not to get better at it.
You know? I think a lot of people take pictures because they like the pictures.
Yes, but you don't think that they get better at it?
No. I don't think that's the goal. It's just to record moments. I know a lot of people that use their phone or that use a point and shoot or even use SLRs that could care less about a lot of the things that we talk about. That could care less about technique. They could care less about aperture. It stays in program mode.
No, that's fine.
There's no getting good. It's just, I enjoy this. Then why shouldn't that matter?
But I think that people enjoy it because I think that people enjoy things because they get some sort of satisfaction out of doing them. And I think when you get satisfaction out of doing something, you are sort of by definition practicing that thing, right? In much the same way that, you know, doctors practice and lawyers practice, you know, like you are in practice of, say, taking pictures, and that is the doing part. And in this case, that's the get good part. The thing about this quote is that in many ways, the be good and the give up are very much secondary, right? To me. Like, for somebody to say, wow, you're good, you don't need to do it anymore. Well, that's not really what he's saying. What he's saying is that, like, if you're not satisfied at how well you're doing something, do it a whole bunch so you get good at it. And if you don't want to do it a whole bunch, then why are you upset about being not good at it? You know, like that. There's just three states, you know.
Then really, that also, go ahead.
Really, there's just the one state, which is the doing, the middle one.
Yeah, but if you're just repeating the motion without intent, which a lot of people do, there's no getting good. You're just repeating the motion. It gets us back to that. You have to first learn how to practice.
Right. Okay. But you're kind of playing two things here, right? Because you're saying there are people who aren't trying to get good; they're just doing it.
Right.
But you're also saying that, like, if you're doing it without intent, then you're not getting anywhere.
I don't think you are.
You're saying that it's okay to just do it without intent and not get anywhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Who do you know who does that? Do you do that for anything?
Do I do that for anything? Just because I like it. I play video games just because I like them.
Right, right. But you're not worried about getting good at playing video games.
No.
Right. So in some ways, this quote doesn't apply to you in that case.
Well, the process behind it does. I mean, I don't play shooters, for example, to get better at them. I just like them. And I know I suck at them because I don't have the Twitch skills of a 12-year-old.
Because you're not 12.
Yeah, you know, and I don't put the time into it.
Just an aside, there's no way to win against the kids.
No.
They're ridiculous. Like, I don't know why anyway, unless you were the first person in on some new first-person shooter online, you might as well not even play, because the people who've been playing since day one, hour one, minute one.
Well, that's the other thing. And they're designed in such a way that you're rewarded for putting the time in, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm going to jump into Titanfall, for example. I'm going to jump in, you know, 2 months after it launches, and everybody's already got, you know, uber weapons and they're leveled up and they've
got
armor, and I'm running around with the standard kit. Nah, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
I don't know. To me, this quote is satisfying. Because,
I think that's great.
Yeah.
I think that's great. I just don't think it applies to everyone.
Oh, of course. I mean, it doesn't apply to everyone in every instance, but I think that if what it is that you enjoy doing something and you're trying and you're somehow frustrated with the level at which you're doing it, there's really only one choice, you know? And
I see it.
And I tend to disagree with you in the whole, you know, There are things like playing piano for which if you practice incorrectly, you will actually do damage.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can really screw up your technique if you do it incorrectly. Same thing with, say, a golf swing or something like that, right? Like if your muscle memory gets such that you're actually doing it in a way that will limit you later.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I feel that way about things like photography. Like, I think
look at typing.
Yep. Yep.
I've been using a computer forever. I've been typing on a computer forever. I'm a horrible typist because I only use the first two fingers and my thumbs on each hand. I don't use my ring finger and my pinky finger on each hand. But I've been doing it so long that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for me to learn any different. But I've been practicing at it.
Yes. Yes. But again, that's very similar to my piano or thing. That's like muscle memory where it actually, whatever. But if somebody says, you know, go and here's a pile of paints and a pile of canvases, just go do it. You don't think that somebody's just going to get better just by doing it a whole lot? They might not get as better as quickly or in the direction they want to get.
Yeah. But like, look at your mom or your dad.
Yeah.
They took pictures the bulk of their adult lives.
Yeah,
are they any better noticeably than when they started? No. My parents weren't.
Right. But that's in the same way that, you know, I pump gas hundreds of times and I'm no better at it now than I was at the beginning.
You said it talks about photography. Well, there's photography.
No, but I'm saying if somebody is intent in doing it, if somebody's like, I want to get better at photography, I don't think there's any wrong way of getting better at photography that involves actually taking pictures.
No, but you just hit it on the head. It comes down to intent.
Right. What? The fact that they want to get better.
Right. Just because you do it over and over and over again doesn't mean you're going to get better at it.
Right. But I'm just saying they don't have to do it over and over again in a particular way in order to get better. I think that any doing it over and over and over again is going to help as long as what they're trying to do is get better at it. You know, mm-hmm. See what I'm saying?
I do.
I always understood your thing is that unless you're practicing in a particular way, you know, doing these exercises in this way and making sure you do that, you're going to get stuck.
And I believe that.
Okay.
It does come down to intent for me. And that those exercises could be as simple as looking at the photographs and going, what's not working here?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess maybe
it's just I should get some of these in focus. Let's start with that.
Yes. Okay. I just, you know, it's funny. I've just never, I've never felt like I got better when I tried to turn what I was trying to, anytime that I tried to turn what I'm doing into a more formalized practice, as mm-hmm. it were, it's never been successful for me. Like whether it's photography or piano or music or it's just interesting. It's like it's the only way that I ever feel like I'm getting somewhere is if I just sort of bite off more than I can chew and try to figure it out.
Yeah, but that's you're still based on intent. The intent is still so I'm doing this in order to get better.
So in your story, the intent is purely mental. It has nothing to do with the specifics of doing it.
No, I think it can.
Okay.
But it has to start with I'm doing this in order to get better, I think.
Yeah. Okay. See, I don't feel that way. And it's just like, I do it and yeah, I get better, but like, I don't think while I'm doing it, oh, this is going to make me better at this. Yeah.
You just said that you do. You bite off more than you can chew.
Yes, but I don't think about it as I'm going to bite off more than I could chew so that this is the way that I get better at this. It's sort of just like,
I don't buy it. I think
don't
you
know.
Do.
I don't think, I never consciously think that way. I just feel like I get bored and so I want more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, just different way of doing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but your game is to, according to this, shoot everything, stop being myopic, start small and build.
You know, a lot of the photographers that we talk about, they weren't sports photographers. They weren't portrait photographers. They weren't wedding photographers. They were photographers.
Yep.
You know, there's a great Mick Rock quote where he said, I you know, my eye was a hungry eye. And I think to a large degree, we've lost some of that sentiment. And if you watch the video that we've included in the show notes for this week's Photographer of the Week, foreshadowing, there's a great bit on this very topic. And I wonder about new photographers starting out going, I want to be a portrait photographer. Well, how do you know? And if you only ever shoot portraits, then you're limiting the breadth of your experience.
Sure. Yeah. But go ahead.
Well, I think that with regard to photography, it feeds every genre feeds off of itself, or it feeds off of each other. All the genres feed off of each other. If you're shooting sports, that's going to inform how you would shoot editorial or how you're going to shoot portrait or, sure, or whatever. And I know when I started in high school, I shot everything that I could. You know, I was buying film and 100-foot rolls. I was shooting all the time.
Right, because you hadn't
yearbook staff.
Because you hadn't yet figured out what it is that you enjoyed shooting, or you just enjoyed shooting, period.
I just enjoyed the process of shooting.
Right.
I enjoyed seeing the world through the lens of a camera. End of story. Yeah. That's what I enjoyed.
But I don't know that that's the goal for everybody.
Well, I don't know that it's the goal, but I think that there can be a tendency to limit what you want to do or what you're willing to do in order to focus on one thing. Our photographer of the week also talks about, he didn't start out shooting for Life magazine or Look magazine. He started shooting whatever he could, wherever he could, for whomever he could.
Sure.
And built a career. There was no, I deserve this. I deserved to.
Well, that's a little bit of a mental leap, right?
What?
Well, I'm not saying that not everybody who starts out and comes up with some sort of specialty thinks that they deserve something or another.
No, but you and I both know people who do.
Of course. Yeah. But those people are, you know, it's the whole thing is like, is the rich guy an ass because he's rich? No, he was an ass before he became rich.
Right. I just think that there's a tendency to be a little myopic about how we approach photography and in terms of what we are or are not willing to shoot.
Yeah. Okay. Are you talking professionally or in general?
Primarily professionally. You know, it seems like
the marketplace has done a lot to that. Even if somebody wants to shoot all kinds of things, that's actually bad for them in the marketplace a lot of times.
Okay.
I'm just, you know, just from my own experience. Even within the world of portraits that I take a lot of different kinds of portraits, and people look and go, "Oh, you take those and those kind." Well, I don't know what to hire you for. Like, I don't know what it is that you do. You know, so there's definitely that market pressure in that direction for specialization. But I agree with you that if somebody is when they first start taking pictures, they should take pictures of everything. Because you never know what it is that it's going to sort of get your goose, you know?
Right.
You don't know what it is that is going to excite you in some way. When I first started taking pictures, I took pictures of all kinds of, and, you know, every once in a while I still do. Like a few weeks ago when I did that, I was taking pictures for my mother for Mother's Day of those flowers. It's like I don't shoot still lifes or flowers or that kind of stuff or sort of macro-y shots, but, you know, it's not really, I'm not all that interested in it, but I wanted to do it to try something different for my mom. So I pulled it out and did it. Now I used to do a lot more of that kind of stuff. Like anything that I could think of that was some sort of mental project, I would just sort of pull it out and do it.
Right.
But then there got to be a point where I realized that there were certain things that I enjoyed doing and there are certain things that I didn't enjoy doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately when it comes right down to it, I think that people need to, they should shoot what they enjoy shooting, right? Because we don't do this, you know, at least I don't do it for any reason other than the fact that I mean, I like doing it, you know, everything else is secondary, you know, I enjoy doing it.
That the whole thing, I should only do what I want to do. That's kind of a load of crap because you learn from the challenges.
Sure, but there are challenges within what you want to do.
Yeah, to a certain degree, but you also run the risk of getting in a rut.
But you know? You're saying that I should, for example, go shoot some sports, and that would somehow help.
I think every once in a while you should go shoot something that you don't want to shoot instead of taking this sort of, you know, they're my toys and I can play with them whenever I want attitude of I only have to shoot what I want. Yes, I do think that.
See, that doesn't make any sense to me. That seems like homework to me.
Well, yeah, and you don't like assignments ever.
Well, I don't like assignments, but at the same time, I don't.
I think it makes you a more rounded person.
Okay, well,
it's the same way of you know, not just looking at photography all the time, right, but going and looking at art or dance,
right,
or film.
Absolutely, and you know, right. But
why should those rules only apply to the inspiration and not the doing?
They apply to both, but they don't apply everywhere all the time equally.
I'm not saying they do, nor did I even infer
that. For example, I read nonfiction books.
Okay. Right?
Every once in a while I'll read some short piece of fiction, but I don't particularly enjoy reading fiction. Now, somebody could say that I am culturally at a deficit because I haven't read all these classics of literature.
True. Okay.
But I'm not going to read, you know, obscure Shakespeare plays because I don't really enjoy reading Shakespeare. Whether, you know, I'd rather go do something else with my time. I think that shooting the same exact thing all the time is trouble.
Yes.
But I don't agree that you should go shoot other stuff just because. If something else interests you, I say go for it, you know? For example, I was down in DC a while back and I was at the Air and Space Museum and some guy had done these shots of the bottoms of, did we talk about this once on the show way back in the day? The bottoms of airplanes when they're taking off. He got off directly underneath them. Yeah. So it was like sort of, these like spot on sort of graphic shots of all these airplanes.
I remember us talking about them, but I can't remember if it was on a show or just you and I talking.
Yeah. And they were really cool. Now, like I
like perfectly framed, like yeah. right as they were going over him. Yeah, I remember that.
It was really neat.
Yeah.
And down in DC at National Airport, there's actually a park right at the end of the runway. There's like this park and you can go sit there and the planes, depending on which direction they're taking off, are either landing right above your head or taking off right above your head.
Wow.
And you know, I mean, they're 150 feet up. It's not like they're right there, but you know, it's close enough to where it's scary, you know, for like my nephew and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I took a camera down there last time and I tried to like see how that guy did that. You know, like where can I set up to actually get this in view, whatever it is. Like that's nothing like what I would normally do, but I did it because it sounded interesting to me, you know?
Right.
But there are other times when I'll carry a camera around with me.
Wait, back up. Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did.
Did it change the way you see something or did it inform the way
course,
you see?
But okay. I didn't do it because I felt like I need to do something different, you know, or else I'm going to be trapped. And even if I don't enjoy doing it, it's like if you see something else that you want to do that you think you would enjoy, I say go for it all the time. But like if you know you don't enjoy something, I don't want to eat Brussels sprouts all the time just to like change my palate when I really don't like Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to make sense to me. Like maybe you're right. I don't know. Like for me, I guess I find enough little things to change that it keeps it interesting for me, you know, but there are times when I'll carry my camera around with me for hours, like on a walk, long walk someday. And I'll realize I didn't even take one picture on the way home. And I was just like, why did I even carry this all the way? Like if there's something I really see, I'll pull out my phone because I have that, you know, if it's something I really need to take a picture of. So I've sort of come to this place where I realize that I don't really enjoy carrying a camera around the city for street photography. Now that's what some people do all day long. You know what I mean? Like that's all they do.
Right.
You know, and hey, if you enjoy that, that's great. Like I don't enjoy it. Like it doesn't do anything for me. And even when I do take pictures, I don't come back and say, oh, that's really interesting. I look at it and go, wow, that's really mediocre. And then I don't show it to anybody, you know? So I think that I understand what you're saying, but I think that there are limits to the theory, I guess. And certainly somebody who has only been doing this for a year or two and hasn't explored all kinds of facets of it, to realize that there might be a corner of photography that they would really enjoy if they only got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Nikki's big on the food photography.
Right.
You know, did she do that because she liked cooking or because she just started taking pictures of food one day as a necessity for the cooking? Or was it, you know what I mean?
I'm not sure actually how it started or why.
So I sometimes think about that kind of stuff. You know, it's like you stumble upon things, you know. My mother said to me, your portraits are really good. You should take more pictures of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I started taking more portraits. So it's, you know, who knows what will end up doing it, you know.
I would like to take a little while and focus on architecture. I've been looking at a lot of architectural photography lately. And I look at the one name I can pick out of a hat is Julius Shulman.
Sure.
And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, you got to go find yourself some cool buildings.
Yeah. And then there's the interesting sort of technical requirement of you know, typically architectural photography, they want things at you know, the right angles. Yeah, they don't want parallax. They don't want, you know, which is odd because that's not how we see things, but okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
You can do a lot of that stuff in post now,
or at
least, you know, some like minor things. You don't really need the tilt shift lens. You could just play around with perspective and Lightroom or whatever.
Right.
Absolutely.
It's interesting.
I find architectural photography fascinating. It's kind of like, I don't generally see that many. Most of the architecture that I find interesting is not brand new.
Mm-hmm.
Or the stuff that is brand new and smaller is not interesting to me. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
the things that Shulman was shooting were really cool buildings. You know?
Oh, yeah. Sure, sure, sure.
And yeah, I bet
some
you,
of the most iconic buildings right. in LA.
Yeah, or, you know, and these or these really Art Deco-y things where like mm-hmm. the angles were just right, or these curves, and I am, yeah, I'm totally founded by that. But in some ways, what I kind of realized there is that what I'm really interested more in is the architecture, not the photographs of the architecture.
Sure, sure.
You know, so then I think, man, should I just start reading up on architecture instead of doing right. the photography of architecture?
Instead of photographing, yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, so you go back in circles, you know. It's tricky. All this stuff's really, really tricky.
Yeah, but interesting. Very
absolutely.
Interesting.
I spent like 4 or 5 hours on Friday with a new friend, this woman, Ashley Bathgate. She's a cellist. She went to Bard, you know, where Steely Dan went, and for undergrad, and then she went to Yale grad school for.
Hold on.
What's that?
There's really nobody named Steely Dan. You know that, right?
I know Steely Dan, the band, the entire band went there.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. No, I realized that.
Okay. Just making sure.
yes. All of them went there, including Chevy Chase, who at one time was their drummer, right? Isn't that the apocryphal story or the semi-apocryphal
story? That's the story. I've heard that story.
Yeah. Anyway, and then she went to Yale grad, and so she lives down here in the city, and she like plays cello all the time. And it was just fascinating talking to somebody in a different art form about sort of surviving within their art form,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just,
now, did you photograph her at all?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's what we did for 4 hours. In fact, it's funny, when we were leaving the house after we shot for a couple hours, went up, got some lunch, came down, shot for another couple hours. And then we were leaving and I was like, oh my God, I just realized I didn't hear you play a note. Like, I just, for some reason, it never.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And I was like, what the hell are we doing? And I'm like, come back upstairs. And she's like, yeah, no, next time, whatever it is. But it's just, in some ways, at least for photography, there's a market for the skills, you know? Even mediocre photographers can make some money being a photographer. A mediocre musician, especially in a place like New York, never going to get anywhere just because there's so many really great musicians who will do it for next to no money, you know?
Right.
So in some ways we're all very lucky that we sit here and complain about how there's no money in photography anymore. There's really no money in music or all kinds of things, you know? And she's fantastically talented. Friend of Todd Reynolds.
Okay.
They play together. And it's just really great, you know, talking to somebody who's high end in what they do too. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure.
It's fun. It's good stuff. Hey, so Alan Bailward.
Who?
I think he's in the Google group.
Yeah.
Sent us, he's actually, I think he's in what, Scotland for 3 weeks or something. Yeah. So I just wait, cut to Alan Bailward, like speaking with a Scottish accent. That'd
yeah.
be
no.
awesome.
No. No.
Sent over what is this? The Art of Photography. I've never watched this video podcast.
This is, it's a show by a guy called Ted Forbes.
Okay.
I forget what museum Ted works for, but a good guy, knowledgeable guy, very knowledgeable.
Okay. I should probably watch more of these.
Yeah. Good show.
The Art of Photography.tv. And it was his episode about Vivian Mayer, who we've talked about a billion times.
Right.
And this guy's basic take on it is that, yeah, she was a good photographer, but these people who found her pictures, who are putting them out it's just a big marketing push. And there's a handful of great pictures, but then there's a whole bunch of just scan negatives that they're throwing up there, and that they're amateur curators, and therefore the decisions they're making aren't necessarily valid, and all kinds of things like that. And that while her work was very good, when you put it up against other street photographers working at the time, it was nothing special or life-changing as some people make it out to be. Is that fair?
I think that's what he's saying. Probably, yeah, it's close.
Okay.
I think one of the things that he really kind of not rails against, but is down on is the sort of posthumous editorial process of her work.
Yeah. I mean, he said a number of times, like, the one thing that an artist should choose to do is like the artist should get to edit their work.
Right.
And that the fact that she didn't do anything with these pictures over her lifetime meant that she didn't want them to be out there in this way, probably. That's what I kind of read that as.
Yes and no. Yeah. I mean, there were so many of them. I think the majority of them are undeveloped.
Yeah.
But she, if you watch the film, which is a terrific film, she was approaching different printers, trying to get, you know, cards and prints done. So if that was the case, then doesn't that mean she did want to get them out there?
I think that means she wanted postcards so she could send them to her friends. I don't know. I don't know. You know, so it was interesting, but the reason I wanted to bring it up is very little to do with Vivian Mayer, but like the fact that he kind of kept calling the two guys who found the negatives and run these books and print things. He was saying that, you know, that they're sort of curatorial amateurs,
mm-hmm.
and that they don't have any specialized training in this, and that curation requires more than just whatever they have. It requires years of schooling and I'm sure some sort of certification or, you know,
right,
whatever
right.
it is. And it kind of irked me a little bit, 'cause I was like, what kind of ivory tower BS is that? Like, you know, and it kind of made me think, is curating more than just having good taste? Does it require, you know, years of training in the history of art, and is that training in the history of art enough, or do you need that and good taste and whatever else, some magical X component?
Well, I think that the art establishment wants you to have those things.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. Is that
the credentials are very important to the art world?
Yes,
very important.
But what do they mean? You know what I mean? Like, other than...
I don't know that they really mean anything. I mean, does anyone know where...
Does anyone really know what time it is?
Yeah. Does anyone know where Coco Chanel studied? And does it matter?
Right.
Does anybody know where Deanna Vreeland studied? And does it matter?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Alexei Brodovich? Does anyone know where Brodovich studied? And does it matter? I find this ridiculous that somehow I think we are in a post critic capital C and post curator capital C era.
So you're saying that like we're getting to the point where the training is irrelevant.
I don't know that it's irrelevant, but
or is not a good measure. It certainly isn't a club that you can't enter without it.
Correct. If I'm looking for a movie, if I'm going to go see a movie, I don't care what Peter Travers from Rolling Stone says or Rex Reed. I'm going to go to Rotten Tomatoes and see what people who've actually seen the movie, you know what I mean?
You're okay with popular opinion, a popularity contest being the judge of this stuff?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
But I think the popularity contest would have thought that Pollock was crap.
And a lot of people still do.
Right. Okay.
But I don't think there is the measure any longer. I think there are several A measures.
Yeah. I think there'd be people, and I'm not necessarily one of them, but I think there'd be people who would argue that the whole point that this sort of system evolved was to give it another layer. You know, it almost feels like, there was a time when there were too many people with too many opinions, not enough of them informed, right? Mm-hmm. And out of that came a subclass of people who were well-informed people, the capital C critics, as you would call them, right?
Right, right.
And curators and whatnot.
Right.
And then what happened is that 100 years passed, and those people, instead of just being the really smart guys who were the best people at this, it became a system that created these people and gave them false importance.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Sure. So that it's sort of like what they became was not what it was originally. And maybe the sort of downfall of this whole thing, or the rise of the internet and all the rest of it, is just flattening that out again. And then there will be people, in much the same way, there are like reviewers of gadgets, right? There's 400 billion people who would tell you what the new X whatever cell phone is, right?
Right, right.
But, you know, you like that one kid, who's the little 18-year-old black kid?
Marques Brownlee.
Marques Brownlee.
Yeah.
Right? You like him, and you think he's great.
One of the best reviewers in tech. Yeah, right, he's fantastic. Right, right.
But, like, he wouldn't get the time of day as a 17-year-old kid 10 years ago.
No.
But now he's one of the top guys, just because he does good stuff and was on YouTube at the right time and all the rest of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it all got flattened out, and now theoretically other people will come in to take their place who were probably much more in the vein of the original critics from the turn of the last century or what have you.
Sure, sure. Maybe,
you know,
yeah.
In some way.
Yeah, I could see that.
I feel like it's similar in academia, right? You know, where the physicists around, say, World War II, who were doing like the atomic bomb stuff and all the nuclear stuff that was big at the time. Were making huge strides because they were like splitting atoms and looking at quarks and all this kind of stuff. A lot of them, yeah, they were university guys, but they were just like crazy smart guys who were throwing stuff around and coming up with answers. And right. Then the whole thing got sort of codified in the 80s and 90s and teens, where now it's inside the universities in this sort of insular way and has lost some of that heat. And maybe I'm completely wrong, but like, I feel like there's this, I feel like it's the same way with the critics. So it just, when he was saying that, it gave a bad taste to my mouth. I was like, well, who the heck are you to say that? I mean, that these guys couldn't choose good images. Like, maybe you don't agree with those images that they chose. Does that mean they chose bad images because you disagree with it?
Right. You know? I mean, I've been to shows at museums and galleries that were curated by someone who's got the credentials, and I thought they were crap.
Right, exactly. Yes. How many shows have you and I been to? I'm tired of trying
to be convinced that something's important. And if it really does just come down to an emotional response and whether you like it or not, then is there a danger of the bottom falling out of the art market?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that that might help your whole thing of the past few weeks, which is that we should all be buying art cheap.
I think we should just be buying art.
Yes.
I think we should be trading art. I think we should be bartering art. I think we should surround ourselves, or at least have things in our lives, in our homes, in our cars, in our office spaces that we just like to look at.
Yeah.
They don't serve any purpose other than to bring a smile or a joy or a memory or evoke some earlier time. It doesn't have to have a purpose, folks.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just want to have things around you that you like to look at.
Yeah.
You know, and I think with these guys, you know, I don't know what Maloof's credentials are. I don't know what...
Whatever the other guy's name is.
Now I don't remember his name. Anyway, but it doesn't matter.
Right, right.
You know, if you like the picture, you like the picture.
Yeah.
If you like the painting, the sculpture, whatever it is, I don't care if you buy it at a flea market in Santa Fe, New Mexico, or, you know, at some gallery in New York City. If you like it, you like it. Yeah.
I will say that I agree with him in the sense that I feel like her work in particular was that it was always a big, long marketing campaign. In the press stories and the books and everything like that.
Sure, I can see that point.
There's part of it that feels icky to me.
Mm-hmm. I can see that point. I think her work's good. I don't think it's the greatest thing I've ever seen. I mean, if looking at, you know, a Fred Herzog piece side by side with hers, I would rather have one of Fred's pieces because they click with me more.
Or Saul,
sure. Or, you know, or Kritesh or Aceh or something like that. You know, I didn't know about Aceh or Kritesh before I started doing this show. And I've become fans of both of them.
Yeah.
Not because of their legacy per se, but because their photographs just kind of kind of, you know, hit home with me.
Oh, they knocked you over.
They did.
They bowled you over.
They bowled me over.
Anyway, I guess I have to go watch some more of this guy's things.
Yeah, he's got some really interesting stuff.
It was interesting in this one last thing about this is how many times he felt like he needed to apologize for his views.
Yes.
He's like, I'm sorry. I know there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be really upset at me about this.
A lot of people aren't going to dig
this. Yeah. He said it like 12, 15 times during it.
Yeah. He's got some good stuff. They've got two new shows. One's called like Photo of Threes or Photo Threes, I think it's called, where they do like you know, three color photographers that changed photography
that's kind of neat.
You know, three musician photographers or, you know, stuff
three
like that.
Three landscape guys.
Yeah. And I like him, Ted Forbes. Really seems like a good guy.
Yeah. I tended to agree with him on most of the stuff he was saying. So I found it fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We got a lot of stuff here. You like this overexposed thing. All right. Tell me about this.
I find it interesting. Okay. NPR article called Overexposed? Camera phones could be washing out our memories. And there's a little audio portion. It's about 6 minutes long. I encourage you to listen to that. But the premise of it is, and we've talked about this a little before, but now there's apparently some study behind it. Is taking a photo of so many moments taking you out of the moment? And there would be, you know, apparently there's research to indicate that, yeah, it's affecting our memory of things because we are more concerned about getting the shot than experiencing the thing.
I say yes.
And I find this interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
I was walking through the park yesterday, Prospect Park, and I saw this woman. He's like two little kids, like sort of ran away from the parents sitting under this tree, you know, like with a lunch or whatever. And the kids were running down the hill and the mother got up and was like, hey, where are you guys going? Like, and you know, follow them. They were, you know, little, like four.
Mm-hmm.
And she got up and she saw them run down the hill and she went and picked up her camera and walked down towards them and started taking pictures of them. It's like, instead of just going and playing with your kids,
And
I felt like it's sort of, it almost felt like it wasn't just, oh, I want to record my kids. It's like, I want to record how my kids are so perfect. Like it was some kind of like weird thing like that.
Well, and that's kind of what they allude to in this article is woman's talking about, you know, she estimates, you know, 10,000 photographs of her kid. And it's like, well, okay, I'm not a parent and I don't mean to be dismissive towards parents, but you know, if you've got a 2-year-old and you've got 10,000 photographs of them, how different can those photographs possibly be?
Yeah, yeah. And how many of them are the ones that you remember? How many of them? You know what my kind of test tends to be? I think to myself, if somebody wiped out my entire thing and said, which ones do you want back? Tell me which images. And I go, oh, I want that one of my sister doing this. I want that one of Heather sitting by the beach or whatever it is, right?
Right.
Like the ones that I can remember as the ones that I feel terrible that I lost.
Right.
Those are the ones that would be the real deal.
Sure. Sure. And there does seem to be, you know, according to this article anyway, there's a cause and effect issue. The idea that we, you know, experience less, was kind of the basis, for this study by the psychologist. What was her name? Linda Henkel.
Linda Henkel.
She researches human memory at the Fairfield University in Connecticut, began an experiment by sending groups of students to the university's art museum. The students observed some objects and photographed others. Then back at the laboratory, they were given a memory test. Henkel found what she called a photo-taking impairment effect, quote-unquote. The objects they had taken photos of, they actually remembered fewer of them and remembered fewer details about those objects. Like how was this statue's hands, positions, or what was this statue wearing on its head? They remembered fewer of the details if they took photos of them rather than if they had just looked at them, she says.
I'm not surprised by that.
Yeah, and I find it interesting. And it kind of goes back to, you know, they mention in this some of the things that we've talked about where you've got thousands and thousands of photos that are on a hard drive somewhere.
Yep.
You know, and what happens then?
Yeah. You know what I find interesting? Sometimes I'll be looking through the viewfinder, taking pictures of somebody or something, right? And I'll be so intent on composition or trying to get the light right or whatever, you know, the sort of stuff that you have to think about while you're doing this.
Sure.
And then I'll get home and not realize that his tie was twisted.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like these sort of like little things that I should notice in the moment, but I'm thinking about so many other like sort of one step right, up kind right. of things.
Well, isn't this why so many like fashion photographers in particular use stylists?
Oh yeah. If you're really doing it, that is amazing. If you have somebody there who will come in and go, hold on a second, and like fix three hairs that you didn't notice.
Sure.
That's why those people are great to have around. But you know, of course, you don't really have the budget for those and a lot of editorial stuff.
Right.
But it's yeah. And it's funny how like you don't, it's sort of, you literally can't see the trees for the forest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you're looking at the forest and you're completely missing all of the trees.
Yeah.
And so I can totally think that this is true. And, you know, I think that it's slightly self-serving sounding, but it's part of the reason why I don't really take that many pictures. Like when I'm out with friends and stuff, it's just like, I'd rather be with my friends, you know, it can't always be about taking pictures. Even with my niece and my nephew, like when Agnes, my niece was up here, whatever, 4 weeks ago, I think I took 10 pictures of Agnes in a day. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I don't get to see her that often. So I took 10 pictures and some of them are sort of snap, 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 trying to get her to look the right way kind of thing. So I could probably go back and delete. But there's a certain, you know, we've talked about this before that there's that digital has allowed us to throw frames at the problem.
Sure. And if you're taking photos of every moment, how do you separate the special ones?
Right. Right. Exactly. You know, but then again, the flip side of that is how do you know that the special one isn't, you're not going to notice the specialness in hindsight in which you had a picture of it.
Yes.
You know, so I mean, there's, you can play this both ways, right?
Sure.
But for me, most of the images that I not only enjoy, but the ones that I think back of fondly were part of a larger experience, either in the process of taking the person's picture and meeting them, if they're portraits, because I enjoy a lot of those interactions. Or it's, oh, I remember when Conrad and I were at whatever, Glacier Point, overlooking Half Dome at 5:30 a.m. in the morning when the sun was coming up.
I remember that because you called me.
Right. Yeah, I called you. You were up.
You called me. And I'm like, where are you? You're like, I'm on Glacier Point.
Yeah. Sun's coming up. How you doing?
Yeah. What are you up to?
And it's like, you know, I remember those. So I have those pictures, but I mostly remember those pictures because I was with the person I love or I was in this beautiful place.
Well, and Bill, there's one or two photographs.
Right. Yeah.
There aren't 100 of you on top of Glacier Point.
Right. Yes.
It was like, ka-click, ka-click. Okay.
Yeah. Let's move on.
That's it.
Right. I didn't sit there and take 600 pictures. Because at a certain point, then you're just adding to your time later, right? You know, there's getting the shot and then there's wasting editing time.
Right. Sure.
That goes for not just for a job or for a project, but that goes for life, you know?
Sure.
How many people, like I only use a 16 gig phone, but next time I need to get a 32 because I regularly run out of space because every picture I've ever taken since the first iPhone I had keeps getting updated to the new phone. Right. So like where it was, I only needed a gig for my pictures, the first phone, then it became 3 gigs on the second phone. And now it's 7 gigs on this phone or whatever.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right.
Things add up, you know, but again, it's like, how many of these things would you miss? Those are the ones that are important. Those are the ones to make pictures, prints of, and to put on your wall. Because you're going to look at them way more every time you walk out the front door or down the stairs or whatever, you know, than you're ever going to look at them on your phone. And they're going to be more enjoyable because now they're an object, you know?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes.
Back to episode 2.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Go back and listen.
So you wrote a little essay here A little diddling piece. What would you call it? You call it essay? You call it a piece? You call it?
I don't know. It's just kind of a brain dump.
That's not an appetizing image.
I was thinking about tools, the tools we use.
Okay.
And I was thinking about my first camera which was, as you know, if you've listened to this show, was a Pentax Super Program. But it wasn't the camera I really wanted. Since I knew I wanted to get into photography, or since I started taking pictures, what I really wanted was a Nikon F2. And I had elevated this camera to this sort of near mythical Excalibur-esque status.
The F2.
Yeah.
When you were younger, you did, like before you had one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. This was the one I wanted. And I just wrote down some thoughts about it, of how I elevated this thing. And when I did finally get one, I didn't use it.
You were worried about breaking it?
No, God, no. You could frame a house with one of these things.
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah.
I encourage you to read the article, put it in the show notes. But the basic idea was that, was I good enough to use this tool? Was I deserving of the history that had come along with it? And the realization was that I was the roadblock. You know, that if I didn't take great pictures with this, it wasn't the fault of the object, which I call it, capital O. It was my fault.
I'm seeing a pattern.
Are you?
Yeah.
Hit me.
The fact that you always come to the realization that you're the roadblock.
I am the roadblock.
Yeah.
I am the roadblock.
Is that like be the ball?
Be the ball, yeah.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. See, it's interesting though that whenever I got the toy that was sort of the one that, you know when you get something like this and you put it back in its box every night. You know, like that sort of obsessive stuff you do as a kid. You know what I'm talking about? Like, or you put
it's in the article. I took this thing out every day and I would hold it and I would look through it and I would click off imaginary frames when I finally got it. But I couldn't bring myself to put a roll of film through it.
Yeah.
For weeks.
See, I couldn't do it. I would be slightly different in the way. This is an interesting little psychological test between you and I.
Mm-hmm.
I would pick up that camera and I would take pictures with it. I would still be reverent of it as almost a religious object.
Yep.
I would take pictures with it and then be frustrated that they weren't as good as the guys I know use it. Not that I wasn't worthy of it, but just sort of like there's so much work to be done. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
It's interesting though, because in some ways I feel like that sort of attachment to the tool that you're talking about, especially like the stuff that happens when you're like a teenager or, you're 15 years old,
right?
14 years old. Those kinds of things that you get that sort of are really special to where like the point where you like sleep with it kind of thing.
Yep.
I think that is the emotion, the feeling that a lot of people who are listening to this show are trying to get by buying a new camera.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Because even when I buy new stuff and, you know, and I every once in a while buy new stuff that I actually use, you know, when I buy a new 5D now, I don't look at it as, I just pick it up and go, oh, that feels pretty good. Let's go take some pictures. But part of me wishes that I would get that same sort of inspiration, that same sort of, I can do anything. I'm a superhero magic that I got when I held Excalibur.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does.
And
that's exactly what I felt and hoped for when I got my F2.
Even mass produced things feel like it's the only one in the world.
Yes.
This is my weapon. It is the only one like it, but you know, it's not the only one like it, but it is mine. You know, it's sort of, it's that sort of Full Metal Jacket thing going on.
Yep.
And I totally understand what you're saying. And I think that all of us are trying to sort of get back to that cherry high that we had at that first time, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, you give examples of Winogrand and Irwitt and Jim Marshall's Leicas, right?
Right.
M4s, all of them, or actually hell. One's an M3.
Yeah.
They're all beat to all, you know, all get up. And Winogrand's looks in good shape compared to the other two.
Yes.
But you're also talking about people who were older. These are people who were our age or older who had been using these cameras for years. I wonder if you saw Gary Winogrand's first camera, if he was still alive, if he could tell you that he felt the same way you did with yours or the way I did with mine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that the sort of coming to terms with the fact that the camera is just a machine that's used to take pictures. And yes, you can get attached to it in the sense that you like your camera, it feels the way you like to feel, but that it's useless unless it's being used.
Right.
And
well, and that's what I see. That was kind of the thrust of this is I had elevated it partly because of its build, partly because of its, you know, design, but mostly because of its legacy.
Yeah. But in some ways, you were doing a disservice to it by not using it.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's more offensive than having taken it out and not being worthy in it. Not using it at all is much worse.
Yes.
Right. I totally get it.
And I say in this piece, what I had come to realize over those long years since high school is this tool, which was not so different from a hammer or a cordless drill, had become a talisman of sorts. It was no longer a camera, but rather an object, capital. Not for using, but for merely admiring.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that has gotten lost, and this is just a reality of the modern world, you are not going to hand down your iPhone to your child and say, this is my iPhone, you take it and use it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Use it well.
Yeah, right. Like it's never going to happen, right?
Right.
The world
has
changed. It doesn't work like that anymore.
Right.
Maybe it should, you know, I would love it if it did in many ways. But it's not, you know, if I ever had a kid, I could hand down my M4.
Sure.
Now, will he be able to get film in 20, 30 years? You know, if it's a son, like maybe not, you know, but it's at least like a hunk of something that was mine. And things that are physical as talismans of family and of continuity and of all those things, that's a valid way of seeing it. Right. Mm-hmm. But in the same way, I mean, as we said in episode 22, Winogrand's told his wife to sell his camera after he died and to sell it to a working photographer who's going to use it.
Right. Right.
You know,
right.
I don't want this instrument to be sitting in a case somewhere. I want somebody to be playing it. My grandfather, my mother's father, had a violin. He was a violinist his whole life, jazz violinist. And when he was a little kid, his father took out a loan, like basically, you know, was paying off payments. In fact, the payment book is still in the case with the violin from like 1922 or something.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was a violin. It was a Strad copy that was made for the some orchestra, the chief violinist of some big theater in Bridgeport. And it was designed to be a little louder because it was meant to be used as like a theater violin. So it had a different kind of sound post in it.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
And the guy didn't pick it up or didn't like it or couldn't afford it or whatever it is. So my great-grandfather bought it from my grandfather. And my grandfather used it through World War II, through Korea, through USO shows, through, you know, I mean, this is like, you know, you open up the case and you can smell the history kind of thing.
Yeah, sure.
And it sits, I guess it's at my mother's house, you know, somewhere in a closet or something. And as somebody who was a musician for years, my mother's not. My mother sees it as her father's violin that she can't bear to get rid of. I see it as that beautiful instrument sitting in a closet when somebody could be using it. Like my grandfather's story was told. Yes, it was told with that violin, but the best way to hand that down is to somebody who's going to play it more because that thing wants to be played.
Sure.
So I applaud all this stuff. I think it's interesting. And I think that as I get older, I see these things much more as tools that let me get my job done. And some people say that I'm not, that I throw my stuff around too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the famous story, I was over at Jay Mazel's house and I pulled off my 35 1/4 and I put it on the end of the table and apparently it was too close to the edge.
Yeah. He kind of called you out on it.
Yeah. Jay's just like, Wadman, you are an a-hole, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, because he thought I was being too flippant with my gear, you know?
Right. Disrespectful to the object.
I guess maybe, or just maybe he was just cheap and he's like, you're going to break it and then you got to pay for a new one. You know, I don't know. By the way, I fixed my 85 1/2.
I read.
There was a screw loose. Anyway, I understand what you're saying here, and I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, good.
It is good stuff. Thank you. Wow, what else do we have left?
What else is in here? The hardware to software thing.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's funny. Things, at least in the music world, are going from, say, a certain a sound module that is a physical thing that plugs in with MIDI to all these soft synths and things, right? And now hardware stuff like MIDI controllers and stuff are now getting turned into iPad apps,
right?
That cost, what, a fraction of what the hardware thing would cost.
Yeah, okay, so there was a video going around not long ago about a guy who remixed the default ringtone for the iPhone. And I thought it was really interesting, and I watched it, and I did some hunting around to see what he was using, because he was using these sort of drum pad type of things, and he was using a product called Machine, M-A-S-C-H-I-N-E.
It's a Native Instruments thing, isn't it?
Yeah, Native Instruments Machine, and you know, it's got these 16, or I think the bigger one has 32 pads, and it interfaces with your computer, their software, and I found that interesting, but I thought, you know what, I'm not going to spend $800 to mess around with this, but turns out that they have an app called iMachine, which is remarkably capable. It's got 16 pads, hundreds of different sound samples, and it's $5. And it just got me thinking about these things. And I started looking at some of these soft synths, and I ended up buying iMachine. I bought Nave by this company called Waldorf, which is an amazing synth. It's not.
I know what you're talking about.
The wavetable synth. Yep, it's a wavetable synth. And I'm just kind of blown away by some of these things. And you and I were talking about it before the show. And there was a thing called Gadget by Korg. And this is kind of what led to this discussion where they've taken, you know, what is it, Bill? 20 or 30 of these?
Yeah, it is a lot of them. Let me see.
Actual like physical modules.
Yeah, no, these are all these little dinky little, I mean, this particular set is just these, a bunch of like toy things that they had designed.
Right.
But yeah, it's like 20 of them, 20 of them.
Yeah, in this app that you can, and they each have sequencers and you can add effects.
It's
and
$38 bucks.
Yeah.
So if you had some kid who wanted to mess around with electronic music or hip hop or whatever it is, you could buy them an iPad and $100 worth of other stuff, and they could make music that would have cost $20,000 to do 10 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I remember going into Ontario Music with my mom and begging her to buy me a Prophet 5.
Right.
Which, you know, would never, ever going to happen. Or a Jupiter, you know, Juno, or a JP6 or JP8 or whatever.
Jupiter 8.
Right? Or like the Oberheim OBX. Remember those? Yeah. Big old fat.
My friend Harden's got like a number of these.
And now you can buy these things on your iDevice.
Okay. Yes. But there are some people who say, but that's not the same. Just the same way that if you had a replica version of your F2 on your iPhone is not the same.
I understood and completely agree. I am just sort of marveling at the tech behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. If it could make my iPhone take pictures as nice as the F2,
yeah.
Then yeah, for $50 that would be a totally cool app. You know?
Sure.
I think that's the difference. Where these, I mean, the output of them is as, you know, nearly as good or as good as any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I love soft synths and stuff. I mean, yeah. you could argue though that the tools, think about the stuff that is in your average camera nowadays. Like the intervalometers and the HDR functionality and you know, whatever, cropping tools or raw I think my 5D, I think I can do raw conversions after the fact or something like that. Like I can shoot raw and then play with the picture in the camera and make a JPEG in the like stuff that like, yeah, I know I don't need or whatever. That doesn't really help. But the fact that you can do that stuff because it's a computer and it can do all these different things that would have taken extra gear five years ago or 10 years ago.
And it's, you're right. It's incredible. I mean, you can, I can do it on my Fuji. You can do it on your camera. You shoot in raw and you go, you know what? I kind of botched that. What if I punch that up?
I'm going to put the green black and white filter on or whatever.
Yeah. And then boom, done. Saves out another image.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's interesting. I wonder if it will ever actually look, we have all of it. Well, could you argue that all of these little, photo manipulation apps on the phones and the iPads that look like a darkroom tray and let you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure there's something where you can like move the print around in the tray or some stupid thing. Yeah. I'm sure it exists.
It uses the accelerometer on the phone. So you've got to like,
I'm sure
the phone back and forth.
There has to be. If there isn't, we're totally making one.
Yeah. We're missing the boat on that.
You know what I'm saying? Right. But like, so obviously that's not the same situation, but like it's coming to photography in many ways, whether we like it or not.
Sure.
But again, the final thing of all of this stuff. Okay. It's just a tool.
Yep.
That kid doing the Apple, the phone remix.
Yep.
He's competent. He's good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can't stand music like that, but he's good at it. You know, he's using the tools to make something. And that is going back to your argument about the tool, not a trophy. It's like, use it or lose it, you know,
agreed.
Give it to somebody who will use it.
Sorry about the noise in the background right now.
What just happened?
There's a big truck outside and I don't know what's going on. Apologies.
There's a Mac Pro outside?
A big truck.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Gotcha. Wow. Wah, wah,
Apple wah, joke, Steve Jobs joke for the win.
Apple stock just dropped 4%.
Hey, the Beats thing still hasn't happened, so. This is the guy. What's the guy's name that I like, the Digital Rev?
Kai Wong.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. Yeah, yeah. So I was watching this, and I was thinking about formats. And we keep meaning to talk about formats, i.e., you know, shooting 6x6 or you know, 35 or full, you know, all these different things. And they were talking about full frame and how everybody thinks, whoa, full frame, we need to have full frame, and it's not good unless it's full frame. And they were talking about how to get more than full frame. So Kai and Locke, his co-host.
The other guy doesn't quite have the same panache Kai has.
No.
Is he supposed to be the straight man? Is that like the joke?
I think so. That's like the joke. Yeah, yeah. So they go and they get a couple film cameras, both made by Fuji, ironically enough. Kai shoots with a Hasselblad X-Pan.
Mm-hmm.
And Locke shoots with this Fuji 6x6/6x7.
It's a 6.7. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Can you do square too?
You can do square or the 6.7. And I'm watching this thing and I was fascinated by this X-Pan in terms of how cinematic the photos look just because of the format.
Yeah, sure.
You know, just because you're dealing with this very wide, basically the X-Pan uses two frames of 35 mil film, you know, together as one frame.
Yeah, it ends up being kind of 6x2.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
Have you ever shot panorama in any way?
Even only like after shot your the fact.
Cameras and cropped them.
Yeah, only after the fact. Yeah, and I would love to get the chance to shoot panorama in camera.
Sure.
Because, you know, and Kai even says this in the video, it really does change the way you see things.
Well, I think that go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think that if you want to just play with it and see how you see things, I'm sure that there's an app for the phone that will just crop the, letterbox.
Right.
The sensor just to play with composition.
Well, 645 Pro does it.
He makes a good point in there when he says Hong Kong is a very panorama good
very
city.
Dense. Yeah.
It is harder to shoot wide stuff like that than you think. I'm saying the capital would be.
Yeah.
I'd like to make it in much the same way that it's doing wide angle landscape images. It's hard to make something that looks like something,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
because there's a whole lot of space to fill, you know? It's really, really interesting. I tend to stay away from wider things for non-artistic reasons. For example, how do you print that out to show it to somebody? You know what I mean? Like, and have it in a book with a whole bunch of other stuff that's a more normal ratio.
Right.
Or nothing that I will ever do will ever be that wide printed, so my clients never need it. So, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I guess I could do it for artistic reasons, but it doesn't make any sense.
It almost all needs to be that wide then.
Yes, exactly.
You know, like the books that that Jeff Bridges puts together, yes, after a shoot with his, yep, wide lux.
Yep.
You know, they're all that sort of same format, so it works.
Yeah, you almost have to do that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I agree with you. It's kind of neat and cool. The logistics of it and then scanning the negatives and all the rest of it, all the normal film stuff that comes along with it. How much do those cost now?
They say in the video that they're both cameras are about $2,000. Each camera is about $2,000.
I wonder if anybody ever made an X-Pan knockoff.
I don't know. I'm looking at a wide lux on eBay that's like a little over 400 now, and it looks like it's in super shape.
Yeah.
It's, you know, $400 or $500. I'd buy one for $400 or $500. Would I spend $2,000? No.
You know, these X-Pans for a while they got really, really cheap. Because there was that weird time sort of early. This was like this weird kind of, oh yeah, there's this panorama film camera. Who, you know what I mean? Like 8 years ago or whatever.
Right.
Where probably 2005, you probably could have gotten one for $500. Now they're getting kitschy again, so they're getting cool.
Well, you can get the actual Fuji branded one.
Okay, you can.
They made it for... they made the X-Pan for Hasselblad. And then I don't know what the
Fuji 35 millimeter panoramic camera is.
Right. I can't remember
We're really talking about here is less formats and more just sort of ratios of pictures, right?
Huh, that's funny. It's called the TX1.
Interesting.
Yeah. And their new digital camera is the XT1. Come on, you guys.
Yeah. Well, they're not very original when it comes to that stuff. Yeah. Here's one on, it's $2,000. It's more expensive. It's funny. That actually looks a lot like a Contax G2. I wonder if they made the cameras for Contax too.
Yeah, the Contax, the Fuji, the Hasi, and the X-Pro, they are so obviously from the same, you know, sort of
parent.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's very cool. I think you should get one. I mean, at the very least, start shooting some panos in your phone or whatever, just to see how it feels, you know?
Yeah.
Again, I think that where he lives is much more conducive to that than say where you live.
Absolutely.
You know, where it's just, you know, okay, look, the horizon, you know?
Like, yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But
carcasses of dead elephants who've come here to
or
die.
Go, you know, yeah. Or go into town. You know, that would be kind of fun. Probably like shooting at like Venice Beach or something like that.
Sure.
Venice.
Yeah.
That would be a good place.
Stretch from Santa Monica down to Venice would be pretty.
Like
fun.
The whole boardwalk, you could probably come up with some really cool stuff, especially if you were like wide angle and close enough.
Yeah, agreed.
It's, you know what it is? It's a special way of looking at things. I have noticed over time, I'm cropping more stuff to 4x5.
Hmm.
I tend to like, I really love shooting square, you know? So I tend to be more leaning towards square where you seem to be leaning towards wider, right?
Like, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's two different ways of looking at the world. Where I want to contain it in something that I can control, where you want to like sort of let things spread out a little bit, you know what I
mean? Yes.
And it's just different ways of looking at it. Similar thing, you know? Yeah, you should get one. Bokeh!
Bokeh! Yeah, love Kai Wong.
Wanted to mention, last week we saw that Photolite Pro, we were talking about that fake lighting software.
Oh, right, sure.
Apparently it is cross-platform.
Which, oh,
okay. is why the interface is stupid. Lowest common denominator.
That's right.
Can you get much lower than the lowest common denominator between Windows and Mac? Like finding something that works for both of them.
I don't know. You'd think there would be by this point, you'd think there would be some sort of, you know, cross-platform interface kit. You know, kind of like what Photoshop has done. I mean, it looks the same on Windows and Mac. So
yeah. Looks good on both of them, actually.
Yeah, they've gone to that flat interface. Yeah. So what, you know, why not?
Yeah. Anyway, so if you heard the last episode and we're just like, oh, I use Windows, I guess I can't play with it. Apparently, it is available for Windows 2.
So tell me about this canoe.
Okay,
canoe.
So Ashley came over the other day, the cellist, and we shot a bunch of pictures. And I had this picture in my mind, and I originally wanted to do it with Jonathan Colton.
Okay.
But he's not, I don't think he's the right guy because I don't think he's quite playful enough for what I wanted.
All right.
I had this idea of somebody in like a canoe or in a boat using, in Colton's case, his guitar as a paddle.
Right, right.
And I never made it happen.
She's going to use her cello?
Right. So I wanted to use her using her cello. So obviously I'm not actually going to put her cello in the water. So the easier way to do this was to just do it as a composite. So I shot her sitting on my like dining room table as if she's in a canoe with her cello off to the side. Right. Rowing.
Look at you all Dave Hill style.
Yeah, exactly. I needed a, and I can go do the water down in the park down here, which is what I did last night, but I needed a canoe or a boat of some kind. And I don't have a canoe or access to a canoe. Right.
Right.
So I put out a thing on the
group.
They
don't have like canoes that you can rent in Central Park. I thought they did.
Well, in Central Park they might, but just getting the light and the angle right and in the water, out of the water. They have pedal boats down here, but it's not quite what I wanted.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Anyway, I put out a call on Twitter and Facebook or whatever, and friend of the show, Mitch Sevier, says, "Hey, I got a canoe in the backyard. As long as you don't need it in water, I can take pictures for you."
Nice.
And so Mitch stuck it up on sawhorses.
Okay.
And I sent him like sort of, okay, here's the shot I'm probably going to use. Here's the angle and whatever it is. And he went and shot it at, you know, basically what I wanted, plus up, down, left, and right a little bit.
Right.
And sent them to me the other day, and we made some changes and did another set the next day. And it totally is working perfectly. It's like exactly what I needed. And
that's
I just want to say, like, the power of the group. You know what I mean? It's pretty cool.
It is a terrific group.
Yeah. And it's working out well. And plus, just to show you that I'm collaborating with somebody else.
I applaud you for your efforts.
Hey, I'm working with a new agent now.
Right.
And I sent her, she wanted to see like 300 pictures or something that she sort of chose that she wanted to play with as part of a future portfolio. And this was weeks ago. And she finally got back to me last week with, okay, here's PDFs of all of the images that I want prints of so that I can, and high res of, so I can use them wherever I need to use them. And I was like, okay, here. Yeah. By the way, going through your entire Lightroom portfolio, trying to find specific images, it's like some sort of a treasure hunt, you know?
Right.
I got to go find that picture of such and such. Oh, right. That's in this folder, you know?
I wish there was a way you could use like, I don't know, certain words or tags or something.
Yeah. Cute.
See what I did there?
Yeah, I see what you did there. But actually, what was mostly annoying about it was not that I couldn't do it easily. It's that, say there were pictures from 365 Portraits or pictures from whatever. They weren't all next to each other. She'd do one from 365 Portraits and then one thing that was just a regular in my portrait.
Okay, so you're constantly bouncing back and forth.
I'm bouncing back and forth between 12 things. And there were 180 of them, and it was like mind-numbing for 2 hours. But
right.
Anyway, long story short, she wants these 11. We decided on 11 by 14 prints of all these things. And we're going to do them. She wanted full bleed, but a lot of my images wouldn't look right cropped. You know, sort of the composition is such that if you crop it, it's not the same picture.
Sure.
So what I'm going to do is go edge to edge, whichever one is longer. So if I'm doing landscapes on landscape paper, it might be 3x2, which means you'll have a white strip on the top and white strip on the bottom, but it'll go edge to edge, left and right. Right.
Interesting.
So I have to print 160 pictures, and I'm trying to decide whether I should print them here or send them out in that many, you know?
What would Elko charge you to do them?
Well, Elko and Adorama.
I love my 14 can't be, what, $3 or $4?
Right, $4.
Okay.
Okay, but $4 times 180 is $700. You know what I'm saying?
And, yeah.
Am I going to use $700 worth of ink and paper?
No.
Well, if I go full, remember, I don't have your printer. I don't have the giant tanks.
Oh, yeah. Well, right? Then, yeah.
You know, and then so I'm, and then the amount but of time so, it'll take.
I mean, the volume's not going to be different.
Well, it will be in the sense that I don't tend to print. But my ink's a lot more expensive than yours is. Because I have to buy the little cartridges.
Right.
But I'm also, if I do a lot of full bleed stuff and a lot of my images are dark, which means I'm using a lot of black ink.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, you're going to be pouring through the black.
Exactly.
Yeah.
On these. So I'm sort of, I'm up in the air about whether I want to just send them out and suck it up and eat the $600-$700 or try printing some of them. So what I've decided to do is order a few prints from a couple places and then bring them home and see how the quality is. You know what I mean? Before
print,
I go dumping.
Print out a couple yourself and kind of A-B them against each other. Sure.
Yeah. And what's interesting though, check this out. So the other week she wanted another copy of my motion book to use. Okay. And I was like, oh, so I go on Adorama, and normally Adorama, they'll print the book and then you have to go, you can either pick it up or they ship it to you. But I usually just go pick it up on 18th Street. And then I see it says, would you like to pick it up at our Brooklyn location? I was like, Brooklyn location? What are you talking about? The Adorama Prints and Books has a new like lab that they do it in.
Hmm.
It's a 10-minute walk from my house.
And do they just do the books there, or can you get
individual sheets? I think they do prints.
Sheets?
My guess is that they do prints too there. Is it
their thing, or are they subcontracting through somebody
else?
No,
it's their thing because I went and picked it up. And so I put in this book and it said, you know, 2 to 3 days or 3 to 5 days or whatever.
Right.
And the next morning I got a thing saying, oh, it's ready for you.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think the new location is sort of not as busy. You know what I mean? Like they're not backlogged at all. So I think what I might do is just send in, say, 5 prints, get them back, check them out, compare them. Anyway, it's just, it's stuff gets really expensive, you know?
Yes. I mean, especially in at that size, in that volume.
Right. And I'm getting those, you know, what is it called? The Pinot Cigarro, whatever, you know, those post based portfolio books.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
you know what
okay.
I'm talking about? It's
okay.
PZ
yep.
something rather. I mean, the book and the pages is like $120.
Yeah.
You know, for like.
So you're looking at a grand all told.
Yeah, you know, just dump it in
close to it.
Yeah, and it's like, it's daunting.
Yeah, but if it gets you 1 gig, that's paid for it.
Yeah, I know. It's just it's daunting now, just like dropping $1,000 on stuff that, you know, it's amazing how many people actually still want to see books.
Yeah.
You know,
I say have them done.
You say send it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's done. You don't have to mess with it.
Yeah.
It's time that you could be spending shooting because you're going to angst over every single one.
Yeah.
And that's assuming that you get it right on the first try, which you're probably not.
Right. And then you want to
make
eat
some
another,
tweaks.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Eat more the, paper.
Well,
more ink.
The only other question is if I get this first batch made up, but then I want to do more when I add to it, just do them here. If they're going to match enough,
yeah,
that
there's
going to
be an
stupid.
Inconsistency. Yeah,
so
sure.
There's like, there's
you're setting yourself up for future.
Yeah, you see, there's
cost.
It sucks. Like there's, it's like it's just a pain in the ass no matter how you do it.
Yeah.
But anyway, just thought that might be interesting. And if anybody has any input or thoughts, let me know.
If whatever you do, throw some photos up. Let's see the process.
I will. Yeah. What else we got? We should go to the group or what else?
What's our time? Do you want to just mention Bunny Yeager?
Oh, yeah. Photographer Bunny Yeager, who I think she was a model originally, became a photographer, did a bunch of those pinups that everyone knows of Betty Page in the leopard outfit and the whole thing, died this week. And I bring it up partly because, you know, it's a known photographer who passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But also in our conversation, I think it was last week.
She had to be in her 80s, didn't she?
85.
Okay.
Our conversation last week about whether women photographers idealize, you know, like see as heroes other women photographers for, you know. So mm-hmm. Here's another woman photographer who back in the day was doing it before even Arbus was doing it, you know.
Right. Right.
And working in what was probably very much a man's world.
Absolutely.
You know, rocking it now.
There's a, where did I put it? Oh, I the Flipboard magazine, the Fade and Blurred Flipboard magazine, I flipped in there a story from The Guardian on female photojournalists, like combat photojournalists.
Yeah.
That was fascinating.
Man, that's got to be tough.
Yeah, like frontline in the thick of it.
Well, didn't some woman die recently?
Yes.
Yeah. Was it with like the last they heard, she was like on the road with some rebels or something like that?
And yeah,
she
was killed by a cop. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? Screw that job. It's like I would be so bad at that job.
Yeah. What was her? Niedringhaus was her name. Anja. Anja. Yeah.
I'm way too much of a wuss for that.
Yeah.
Hey, what's the assignment? How did everyone do on the assignment last week? What do
you Shadows?
Think? Yeah.
Shadows, they killed it again. Yeah, really good stuff. You guys loving the Shadows. That seemed like a fun assignment. I'm also doing this 5-day quest.
Okay.
Freddie Clark invited me, like taking a picture every day for 5 days of something kind of representative or indicative of your day.
Interesting.
So I did the first one yesterday, you know, kind of fun. But yeah, some great stuff in Shadows. You know, we got people all over the world.
Yeah, we do.
All over the world.
Yep.
And
a bunch of people joined the group this week too. It was like,
yep, 20 something. Bunch of new stuff. Cams. Did you see Cam's email from
oh, yeah.
London? Thank you, Cams. That's amazing. Thank you for that. Looking forward to seeing that. So this week,
yeah,
you know, obvious choice, summertime.
Ooh, summertime.
First day of summer over the weekend, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't Memorial Day in the U.S. signal the actual begin of summer, the beginning of summer?
Yes. Yep. And in fact, yesterday was truly the first day.
Wasn't it the equinox or something?
Well, no, the equinox was a while back, but
that's spring.
Yeah. That's
the vernal equinox,
but it is certainly, you know, I think it's just it's a informal start of summer.
Okay. So summertime, let's see what summertime looks like where you live, work or play.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll put some up.
Yeah. Now I kind of want to go out to Hadley and out to the dinosaurs at the Wheeler Inn that we were talking about.
Well, how far away is that? Half
it's
hour?
Like an hour. Yeah.
An hour? Okay. Well.
Yeah. Or maybe the big windmills out by the wind farm out by Palm Springs.
Just make sure
that's a summer thing.
Just make sure you pee before you go. You'll be fine.
I know.
It's true. That's good. Yeah. Hey, who's our photographer of the week?
Photographer of the week this week, Douglas Kirkland. This is another new one for me, but he's been doing this stuff for 40 years.
Yeah.
And
he's not really so new.
No, but I didn't know
yeah.
his work, and I was just blown away.
Yep.
Now, he's got two sites, and we'll put both of them in the show notes. There's one that's just douglaskirklandphotography.com.
Okay.
Which seems to be an older site. I don't know. It's a flash site, so there's that. But then he's got another site. It's just douglaskirkland.com, which has got seems to be a more complete listing of his work. And a couple things of note. Number one, he's got a category of 8x10 shots that he's done with an 8x10 Deerdorf camera, which I find interesting. And they're recent. They're not, you know, really yeah. old, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever. There's, you know, some recent stuff up there. And I find that fascinating. You've used one of these things.
Yep.
And like I said, it's just got a mystique to me. That sort of large format has this again, to use a word that we've both used, almost a reverence to it.
Sure. There's a difference. There's potentially a difference in the result, right? You know, that you get, cause you get the, you know, has a certain look, but I think most of the difference in large format photography for me is just the process of using it feels
right.
different.
Right.
And therefore it's like, it's not so much the pictures that change. It's the picture that you would take because of the limitations of what you have to do.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, what's interesting about this guy is that, to me, if I look at his work, he feels like he's one of those photographers of that era who sort of hit his like professional stride. I mean, yeah, he was doing stuff in the 60s and the 70s, but he was probably like one of those big guys in the 80s.
Well, you know, he's most famous, I think, for the classic Marilyn Monroe shoot on the bed,
right?
In the white sheet.
Yeah.
If you've seen those shots, that's Douglas Kirkland. What I find fascinating about him, and this is, I kind of referenced this at the top of the show, is that he shot everything. He shot weddings. He shot sports. He shot people. He shot, you know, everything that he could to learn, to improve, to refine. The intent was there to get better.
Sure. Yeah.
And if you watch the video that's also in the show notes, you'll see that. Now, one of the other things that I really like is his love for photo books, his own photo books. I think he says he's done 16 or 17 books. And that approach of creating a monograph or creating a representation for this is where I'm at in my work, in my life, at this point in my work, in my life.
For himself or for other people?
For himself.
Okay.
I think that is just fantastic.
Yeah. And it's only the work since the previous book.
I don't know how much overlap there is. I'm trying to find some info on his books. I've reached out to the publisher. He's got a book that has come out fairly recently called A Life in Pictures, which is more of a retrospective. But then there are other more specialized titles. And like I said, when I hear from the publisher, if I do, I'll be sure to pass it on. But it really interesting stuff. And I've spent a few hours now over the weekend kind of poring over his work. And I really, really like his stuff.
You know, it's kind of interesting and maybe a larger argument of what you were saying before about shooting everything. He seems like what he loves is photography.
Yes. Period.
It could be, right yeah, there. It could be that some people, what they love is landscapes, and they to create that, they use photography.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So maybe it's actually, that's a better way of looking at it, where like what I get off on in photography is not just taking the pictures, but working with the people. Mm-hmm. So it's the people that make it interesting to me more so than even the camera in my hand. So,
right.
So for maybe for him, the end of it is the photograph and the camera. Like that's what he loves. So it doesn't matter
what's
in front of
him. Mechanics of going. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, so maybe what, you know, yeah. Right. So what's in front of his camera is somewhat irrelevant to him as long as he gets to take pictures of it.
Right. Or at least not irrelevant, but maybe secondary.
Yeah. 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 Sure.
A little further down the chain.
Right. Interesting. Just different way to think about it, I guess.
Yeah. But really interesting stuff. So, you know, watch the video.
Incredibly eclectic, right? I mean, this guy's all over the place.
All over the place, yes.
Yeah. And has been there, done that, seen that, you know?
Yes. Joined Look magazine in his early 20s.
Right.
You know, worked with Irwitt and Bresson and you know, knew all those big guys, right? But is still shooting... You know, he shot all the stuff for The Great Gatsby and actually almost all of Lerman's stuff. But you know, passionate about filmmakers and about dance and that shows in his work in that he's shooting all of these types of things.
Right, right.
And shooting them well, I would argue.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating. Good choice.
Yeah, Douglas Kirkland.
Douglas Kirkland. We'll put some links in the show notes. What else you got? Anything? I think we're done.
I think we're good. What are we at on time? Long one?
Yeah, no. We're a buck 40.
Right in there?
Yeah, right in there.
Okay. Okay.
How do people get a hold of us?
podcast@ontakingpictures.com. That's the email. If you want to leave a voicemail, 347-687-9411. You can check out the On Taking Pictures t-shirts at fadeandblurred.com/merch. Pick one up or, you know, or two. They make great gifts.
You know, Lomo makes a panorama camera.
Do they?
That costs $67. It's called the Sprocket.
Lomo.
Sprocket Rocket.
The Lomo Sprocket Rocket.
Yeah. Just, you know, if you want to.
Oh, look, there it is. Look at that.
So for $80, you could get one of those and play with it and see how it fits
you. See what you think. Yeah. Well, that's, they're If you go to Gilt, they're on special for $65.
So you can't go wrong. Or you could get that Fuji GX617, which is like a beast. Which I think
you were telling me about that.
I think it's a 6x12.
It's like a foot wide. This camera.
I think it actually is. Yeah. Oh, Jeffrey, it is. It's you get 8 photos per roll.
Oh Jesus.
Oh no! I'm sorry. Or 4 or 8 photos per roll, depending
on 4 photos out of a 120 roll.
Yeah, 4. No, actually, yeah, 4 photos out of a 120 roll. Yeah, that's exactly what you get.
It's 3 frames, 3 120 frames together as one photograph. That's a big negative.
Yeah, it's a huge negative.
That's a big negative.
Oh my God, they show the back opening of where. Wait, I got to show you this. This is awesome. Show image. Okay. It's the back where like the film gets shown here. Link in the Skype. Just shows you how much gets exposed.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's a cavern, the back of this camera.
It really is. I think you can get lost in there.
Okay, you gotta put that in the show notes. Put this image in the show notes.
So this is a
120 or a medium format panoramic camera that shoots 3 individual frames of 120 film as one panorama. This is a gigantic negative.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So what is that? 18 centimeters across?
Yeah, something like that.
That's a big negative.
Yeah, 18x6. Yeah, that's what it would be. Isn't that awesome?
That's great.
Yeah. That's talk about like, you know, we talk about, oh, I have the hospital, I only have 12 pictures. You have 4 pictures.
Yeah, you have 4 pictures per roll.
Don't screw it up.
Oh, and you could blow that up so big.
Yeah.
You could make a gigantic enlargement out of that. Yeah. Wow.
Somebody just made an 18x54-inch print.
That's great. Yeah, neato.
See, that would be fun.
That would be fun.
All right. Let's see. I'm Bill Wadman on Twitter. You're Jeffrey Sidoris. We talked about all that. Yep. Anything else?
Nope. That's it.
All right. We will see you next week, guys.
Thank you for listening.
All right. Bye.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. This way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear you think out loud, going through your thoughts the way.